got into management.
That's what I was wondering.
Inadvertently.
I was wondering whether you had done anything like organized or done something managerial in any of your jobs.
No.
No.
That second year, as I was deciding whether to go on for the experimental PhD, which I didn't really want to find a job, I did talk with a lot of the head of the physics. He said, you can take a year off and study and come back and take the test. And I said, oh, that's a nice option. But as part of my searching, I went over to, there were a lot of recruiters on campus looking for physics majors. And I started looking at the bulletin board. And I remember it like it was this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Said, would you like to work for the Smithsonian Institution in countries like...
Oh.
In places like, mention U.S. places, Hawaii, New Mexico, Florida, Japan, India, Australia, Greece, Spain, Ethiopia, South Africa, Peru, Argentina, or Brazil.
Wow.
I looked at that.
That's great.
And it blew my mind. I went back and talked to Jean. She had been much greater traveler than me. I mean, she had been to Florida and Canada on vacations. She was.
Yeah.
But Jean has always been an adventurer. If I ever start saying I'm going somewhere, she runs for her suitcase. And it was exciting. So I went for the interview. And a man named Jack Coffey, Coffey, from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, he was the head of the personnel department, was there interviewing. Jack was an amazing man, a unique man. The Smithsonian, one of the branches of Smithsonian was its Astrophysical Observatory, which was headquartered in Cambridge, Mass, in collaboration with Harvard University Observatory. And one of the famous professors at Harvard was a man named Fred Whipple, who was also head of the SAO, the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory function there.
Yeah.
We really were a combined Harvard-Smithsonian organization. And Fred Whipple, it was the dawn of the space age. We're just a few years into it. It's 1963.
Right.
First U.S. satellite went up in 58. First Russian in 57, I think, or 56, Sputnik. And Fred, NASA's looking for, okay, we're going to start launching satellites. How are we going to keep track of them? Fred Whipple was on the NASA Advisory Committee. And he came up with a plan on how to do it. He teamed with two other, I think both were at Harvard, James Baker, an optician, and I don't know the man's second name, Nunn, a mechanical engineer. And they took a Schmidt telescope and modified the Schmidt telescope to track really quickly across the sky while it was running 55 millimeter film through the telescope at a high rate, so you could lock on a satellite, track with it while you're taking pictures of it all along, and the pictures you're taking are reflected sunlight. And the Smithsonian was interested in doing this because they had astronomers who were interested in structure of the atmosphere, and by very carefully monitoring satellite orbits, you could deduce the structure of the atmosphere, where it was heavy and thin, how much. Mm. And another group who were doing geodesy, geodetic work, distances between points on the Earth, and also the shape of the Earth. If you photograph a satellite from two or more stations simultaneously, you could do simple geometry to calculate the distance between the stations. And at that time, on all the major continents, the continents were geodetically mapped from spaces from one point on the continent to the other, because it was all one landmass. But if you jumped, say, from Africa to South America, you couldn't do that. You could only do it by triangulation, essentially, by taking simultaneous observations from the different continents, then tie it together. And so Smithsonian was interested in it for the science.
Yeah.
NASA was interested in it for the bookkeeping. They wanted to keep track of their damn satellites, know where they were. So the jobs at all of these worldwide observatories were every night to photograph satellites that were going over that NASA tasked us to take.
Wow.
And so we had a big computer facility in Cambridge that would keep track of the orbits by teletype, send each astrophysical observing station where you'd see it that night. Yeah. So you had predictions. So you had to track it and reduce all the data and send back all the data that morning. So a typical shift would be from sunset to sunrise. So wintertime, you're working, I don't know, 12, 15 hours. Summertime, you're working maybe 10 hours or something, just because of the how long darkness is in the sky. And a typical observing team at a station, they wanted a physicist, an electronics engineer, a mechanical engineer, other people with just general science or background. And Jack Coffey was the organizational genius on how to put the right personnel together to go out and live in a foreign country.
Wow.
And be successful there and not get people angry in the country. And because you had to do everything with a cooperating agency in the country. So there were formal country-to-country agreements executed with each country in the Smithsonian, and the State Department as a partner to actually do all of this. And so we have to have good relations with the local population, with the local U.S. embassy, with the local government agency that we'd report into. So you wanted people who were also at least the head of the facility had some diplomatic skills anyway.
Yeah, and I was just thinking of the historical context of, I mean, you'd recently had, what, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Cold War issues.
And I could tell you about some of them, but we had real issues with different countries.
I would think.
And so Jack interviewed me. I guess I did well, because he later said that he really wanted me. I took one other interview with North American Aviation. It's transformed into some other big company now. It still lives on, but they wanted me to come out to California, Pasadena or somewhere, I've forgotten. And they were offering me over $10,000. I mean, at 1963, people don't believe it, but that was a big, big salary.
Oh, yeah.
Smithsonian salary was only, I think it was $7,600 starting. But Smithsonian looked so intriguing to me and to Gene. So I'm waiting. I'm waiting for a letter from Smithsonian saying I've been hired. And time keeps going on, and I keep getting letters from North American. If we don't hear from you soon, we have to get somebody else. Finally found out that the man who was the head manager of running all the stations was on a foreign trip. When I was interviewing in Cambridge. Gene and I went over to Cambridge to do an interview there, too, after he...
Okay.
And I did well at that. In the meantime, North American's calling me, and Gene is pregnant, and my draft board in Jersey City is after me like no draft board
the other thing I was
has ever
about.
Been after anyone. I kept getting student exemptions. But they went as far as they ordered me up to Syracuse. I had gone through with the physical. At that time, I must say, while I was not an overt activist, I had strong opinions about the Vietnam War.
Right.
At that time, if you were married, there was no deferment. But if you had a child or your wife was pregnant.
I know.
And so Gene and I got busy. And in the nick of time, she came through.
Yeah.
Our oldest son, Harry. And the damn draft board, when I told them she was pregnant, they demanded a written letter from the doctor and all kinds of test results, which we sent off. I mean, they were vicious. I swear they must have had quotas, and they were going to
do
whatever.
They did.
I was running scared. And so as soon as I joined the Smithsonian, I was doing critical NASA, DOD. We had DOD work, too. I got my automatic deferment. Wouldn't you know, within weeks of Jean having the baby, draft board sent me a letter asking for a birth certificate of our child. Even though Smithsonian was now giving me getting me deferments. But I was important. I mean, I was vital to the country. I was feeling pretty good. It was really fun. We went, Gina, to show you our financial situation. When we went over to Cambridge for the interview, she came with me. She wanted to see what it was all about. We did a week of interview, or thereabout, flying back to Ithaca. I'm still doing things in Ithaca, at Cornell. And we bought a one-way ticket to Cambridge. That's all the money we had. So I got there and went to see the travel office. I said, I need tickets to go. I said, no, when you get back, just send us your report, financial report. We'll give you the form and we'll reimburse you. I said, no, you're going to reimburse me now. Or you're going to have to get me a hotel here because I don't have any money. And I'm saying, oh, God, they're going to fire me. They won't hire me now. But they saw the light. They had a travel office with some nice people, and they got me tickets so we could get back to Ithaca. Still, horrible, long time. Months went by without getting a final offer. And I finally found out when I called Jack Coffey that the man who was the head of all the stations who had been traveling didn't like me, and his name was Ron LeCount. And I said, I never heard of Ron LeCount. He said, no, he told me that when he interviewed you, when you were over here, that he just didn't take to you. I said, Jack, honest, I wasn't. Jack goes and checks and finds Ron was in Ethiopia or something at the time. So finally I got my thing. So I'm ordered, after I got my degree during the summer, to Cambridge for three-week training. Jean and I went. She's popping out. First day, I go in and see Ron. I walk into Ron LeCount's office. I had my sheet, all the appointments. I walk in his office. He said, who are you? I said, Harry Albers. You are not. I thought I was when I walked. When I interviewed you such and such, you had this red vest on, and I didn't like it, and I didn't like you. I said, come on. I said, it wasn't me. I said, I never met you. He finally relented and had this, he was a man. He became my best friend. He was a man who had this gruff exterior. Should I say he reminded me a little bit of Tom Day? But inside was the most wonderful human being. So Ron said, okay, I made a mistake, and I'm glad we overcame this. So I did my three weeks training in Cambridge.
Okay.
They sent Jean and I from there to 3 weeks training in Jupiter, Florida, where there was a tracking station, for 3 weeks training there. And we had a training officer there who was making the final decision on whether you're good hired or not. And I guess I passed muster. And I got my third week in Florida. I got my orders. I'm leaving from Miami Airport to Curacao in the Netherlands Antilles.
Wow.
For a probable 2-year assignment. Now, Jean, at this point, this was in November of 63. Jean had a date of Christmas for the baby, or the first of the year or later, something like that. And our babies, Jean is only 5'2". Our babies are large. I mean, they're 9-10 pounders. And so we got on the plane from Miami to Curacao with her holding her overcoat over her stomach because we didn't think it was known that the airlines wouldn't let you fly if you were too far advanced.
Yeah.
So we got to Curacao, neither of us ever having been out of the country. Wonderful people met us there. And we saw what it's like to live overseas. My goodness. The acting station manager there had everything set up for us. He had found some houses we could rent. We found this lovely, lovely house with gardens all around it. Perfect house. Curaçao has relations with Holland, a lot of relations. If you go to college, if you're a Curaçao resident, you go to Holland, you go to Amsterdam. And a lot of Dutch workers in Curaçao have a home leave where they go back to Holland. So the family whose house we moved into for a year were on a year home leave to Holland, and they had just had a baby. Oh. And so the house was set up for a baby,
nice.
All furnished. It was wonderful. Fruit trees everywhere. Totally fenced in with a wire fence, because if you live on Curaçao, there are herds of goats that wander the island freely, and if they'll come in, and a herd of 20 will strip your property of all vegetation in a half hour. But just a beautiful house. And I started taking up my duties. And my typical schedule was I'd work one night on from roughly 5 in the evening till 10 the next morning, shooting the satellites, producing the data, getting it transmitted, whatever chores we all had individual chores at the observatory.
Yeah.
And then we go home, take a nap until noon, get up, be half awake the rest of the day, sleep, have 2 nights with no work, just day duties at the observatory, and then work another long shift. So one on, two off, continually, with one other person. We worked in pairs because there was a lot of electrical, mechanical equipment that accidents could happen, and you needed 2. Sometimes we'd have 50 satellites coming over in a night, and we really were hopping,
I mean,
to get them all done. But it was great. Curaçao is a magical place. I mean, I was ready to live there the rest of my life, seriously. I never wanted to leave. Harry was born there in Catholic Hospital.
Wow.
One of the funny things, the night we arrived in Curaçao, the acting station manager took us to his house where the rest of the staff were, and they're having a little reception for us, except for the 2 people who were working that night. And they saw Jean pregnant, and they're shaking their heads, and said, "What's the matter?" Said, "You're going to have the baby here?" She said, "Yeah." Said, "You know, there's only natural childbirth here. It's the only way the hospital does it." And that shook us. And everyone's saying, "Jean, you should go home right away." She refused. She said, "No, I'm staying with you." And she wouldn't go. So I was scared out of my mind. While her date was end of December, early January, Harry didn't come till February 13th.
Oh, my God.
We never found out what the reason was.
How much
was.
Did he weigh?
I think he was 7, because he was breech, too. And so we were on strict, she was on strict diet to try to keep him as small as she could. And we were with a Dutch doctor, and Dutch doctors do something different. When the doctor diagnosed she's breech, he called me while I was at work, wanted to come in. "Don't tell your wife you're coming in to see me." I was in a wreck. To see me, told me what breech was, explained it all. "We don't want her to know because we don't like the mother to be, and we know how to do these things." And in fact, the statistics in Holland about birth rates were so superior.
I
couldn't argue with them.
They're the best.
Yeah, they're incredible.
I know.
So I went home and I said, "You know, if I don't tell her, she'll kill me afterward." So I told her. Dr. Van Beek was really angry with me. We went to the hospital. He had a surgeon on hand. Had great staff. Sisters, nuns, nurses, surgeon, Dr. Van Beek, and the surgeon delivered him. And I'm there, he said he wants me at the thing. I literally almost passed out. I was holding on to something, and my legs were going.
Yeah.
He got him all out except for his head. And when he came out from the butt to the shoulder blades. And I remember my thought. I said, "We've just had a ham." This is what it looked like. I saw no legs. They weren't extended. No arms, no head. I said, what is, and it's just his back.
Oh.
I said, what is this? And so the nurse told, oh, Harry, it's fine. We just, and his head wouldn't come out. And so this big, large, blonde, beautiful Dutch nurse finally felt around, found the head, and got, and pushed down hard, and it popped out with the sound of a cork. I mean, and it was, you know, it's still traumatic when I think about it. But just one little quick thing, I won't tell another one. But they're cleaning Gina, and she had been in labor for 20 hours. I mean, it was, she was in and out of, you know, and they gave her, finally gave her something, but it still wasn't what they give the people now. She was still feeling things. So they're cleaning Gina, and the nurse takes the baby, and she's syringing him or whatever and cleaning him. And then she said, you want to follow me? Yeah. So we go over to the scale, and she puts him on. She starts putting this wristband. I said, what is that? I had never seen, been in a hospital, seen a wristband. And she said, oh, that's his identification. You wouldn't want him to be mixed up with another baby. I said, no, do that. So she finishes, gets him in his blanket, and said, okay, you want to follow me into the nursery so you know where he is? Absolutely. Here we go into the nursery. There must have been 40 babies in there. Everyone black, except this one. And I said, do you think he really needed that wristband?
That's funny.
So it became a story in the hospital.
Very funny.
So we raised him there. Dr. Von Veig said, you know, you young people, Gene was only 19 or 20 at the time. I'm 25. Now he gave. We went in for an afterbirth meeting. Now, I want you to be careful about birth control, you young people. You know, do you want one right away? No. This was enough. Well, you make sure this. Sure enough, she was pregnant a couple of months later. So our second one, Bob, was born there too with Dr. Von Veig. And so we had 2 years.
Wonderful.
Of excitement and learning a new culture.
What a great choice.
Yeah. I mean, making friends with people on the island.
Wonderful.
I had always been interested in scuba diving and used to dive in the lake for PatCon on my own, which you're not supposed to do. took a scuba course there. The man, Ron LeCount, sorry, I'm finishing a cold.
Okay.
The man, Ron LeCount, who had been my nemesis about hiring,
right,
was assigned to Curacao as the station manager.
Oh.
He came down. We became close friends. We'd often work the schedule at night together with our scuba tanks and equipment in the car. We'd finish about 9 in the morning, drive right to this incredible beach that was totally deserted, Santa Barbara it's called, and put our equipment on, snorkel out, go down and dive for an hour, bring some lobsters home. We'd always find lobsters. Both of us had gone through a scuba course given by the Antillean Scuba Association, which was a collaborative effort with the Dutch Frogman Service, who were stationed on the island. So our chief instructor was a man named Cappy Lendering, who had the great honor of being the first man ever shot out of a submarine tube in the Dutch Navy. And so we went through a really rigorous course, and we would dive twice a week at least. And that was part of our, and I guess I shouldn't say this, but one time after we were diving, we were young men. We're sitting on the lava, and when you scuba dive, you're weightless for an hour. And your body just feels so good. And your brain, you're so relaxed and at ease. We're sitting there with our tanks still on. We're just feeling good, resting after the dive. And he says to me, Harry, if it wasn't for sex and diving, I don't know what life would be all about.
That's great. I didn't have any idea of that. That's interesting.
Okay, I think I'm ready. So we're back in Curacao. After about, I don't know the exact number of months, but it was probably close to a year and a half, Ron LeCount, who had been the station manager, left, and back up to Cambridge at headquarters to run all of the tracking stations again, along with someone else from General Electric, some executive who had just been hired. And surprise of surprises, he appointed me as the acting manager of the station. I had really done well at that station without work, and on one occasion I drew lots of accolades because one of the things that the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory does is it keeps track of any new comet discoveries, asteroid discoveries, and if anyone in the world thinks they've discovered something, they immediately contact Smithsonian. A man named Owen Gingrich there heads this up, and he coordinates the effort to name it, put out the information, whatever. Well, a teletype came down from Cambridge to us that someone has someone named Bush, I think an amateur, had discovered a new comet. And they were tentatively naming it Comet Bush. And Ron and I were working that night, and we were instructed to search the skies and get an accurate position and time for it. We found it, did a lot of photography of it. It didn't quite look like a comet to me. I guess there was no tail and coma or anything. So I started researching it at night in between photographing satellite passes and consulting the ephemeris, which a book which keeps track of comets and asteroids and other such things. Excuse me. I came to the conclusion it was an asteroid named Ceres. I think Ceres is the second largest asteroid up there that we know about. So I sent a message back to headquarters saying they were about to publish worldwide this new discovery. I told them, hold on, you know, why don't you check out? I think it's this. And the next morning when I came in, sure enough, they had confirmed it was. They had overlooked Ceres, and so I was famous for 3 or 4 days. When Ron left me as the acting station manager, I was befuddled. I had never managed anything. I didn't know anything about it. And so here I am, my first day in the office, management consisted of making up observing schedules, interaction with any local entity we were doing business, the American consulate, making sure the work was being done, just taking care of a myriad of problems, including all the finances, the budget, all the administration. I'd never even balanced my own checkbook. Jean did that. And Ron had this secretary named Millie Coy, a Dutch woman, who was very European, very sophisticated. Billy was probably about 50. I'm about 25 or 6. And I come in, and Ron was about 10 years older, so there was some maturity there. Came in the first day, and I'm thinking, now how do I act, you know, so I can impress Millie? And so I sat down in my chair, and she had a chair and a typewriter alongside mine. And I put my feet up on the desk to be casual and leaned back and fell ass over tea kettle onto the floor. That was Millie's first impression of me. Oh. She resigned later in the week. And I hired someone else who wasn't quite as critical of her new manager. So I went along with... And Susan, in your paper of possible topics, you yes. brought up several times, how do I get into management?
Right.
Well, this was the real one. I mean, acting station manager. But I had picked up little things along the way. For instance, because the people who were being hired to go out to these stations were people like, mostly like myself, new college graduates. We're all pretty young.
Yeah.
Probably the majority had wives. Jack Coffey, this gentleman who was so smart, pushed this. Whereas the people who originally set up the stations were kind of frontiersmen, their day was done. The stations were built. We now needed management, sophistication, science, all those things. So he was turning personnel over pretty good. And one of the things that he started noticing that whenever people resigned before their tour was over, more than half of the time it was not because they're only hiring men at the time, and not because the men couldn't operate in a new culture, but the wives couldn't. And the reason was the men were just having fun, being at work all the time,
sure,
interacting with one another.
Sure.
The wives were thrown upon the local economies, and they really had to
yeah,
integrate, and many of them just couldn't do it, couldn't handle it. And so the organization was losing talent because of that problem.
Interesting.
So Jack's solution to that was, since we were affiliated with Harvard, contacted psychologist or psychiatrist at Harvard, and his name was MacArthur, and he started administering tests to everyone who Jack was considering hiring. They even made an effort to meet wives surreptitiously just to figure it out. And slowly they were collecting data on this. So I know I went through a series of really rigorous psychological tests, written interviews, and putting blocks together, which was my nemesis. And one or two things putting blocks together, it was just impossible for me. And there was this wonderfully cute graduate student who was administering the test, and she winked at me and said, I'll pass you on these, Harry, or else I might never have been hired. But Jack was so innovative. In any case, I spent about 6 months or maybe 8 months being acting manager, and by that time, management was starting to get into my blood.
Uh-huh.
I even found a management book in Curacao, and it was by Peter Drucker. It was his first book, The Practice of Management, and I think I memorized it, or nearly so.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, much later, I became very close with Peter.
Mm-hmm.
He's at the door.
Okay, so can I turn it on?
Yeah. So here I was in a management, unexpected in a management position, and thought I should perhaps learn what I was supposed to be doing. As my time in Curacao went along as acting manager, I started getting ambitious and started bugging Ron and a gentleman named John Shaw, HSIA, who Ron worked for a permanent promotion to observatory director. That was a lot more money. And I liked what I was doing. It went for a long, quite a few months until finally I was contacted. Let me just tell you about this gentleman I mentioned, John Shaw. He's the man from GE who came in to oversee all of this satellite tracking program that was funded by NASA. We're out in the field at the stations. I'm in Curacao. Everyone's out dispersed. The only contact, this is hard, again, one of those things to imagine, but the only contact we had with headquarters was a teletype machine where we sent messages, and messages by mail, which took weeks, there were telephones, but for some reason that was frowned upon. I think in all my years, in my three-some years in the field, I had two telephone calls with headquarters when there were some emergencies. And so when John Shaw was appointed, we read his resume, executive from GE, and he was helpful leather to do things at our nonprofit Scientific Smithsonian Group, the way private industry does. While Ron was still manager at Curacao, John was scheduled a visit to come down. And so to show you how bad communications can be, Ron went out to the airport to meet him. And he has a big sign, John Shaw, because we didn't know what he looked like. And so as Ron and John told us later, here comes everybody filing off the plane. And Ron, every time Ron saw a likely looking, he'd hold a sign, Mr. Shaw. He said, Mr. Hsia. We thought his name was pronounced Hsia, H-S-I-A. Oh. So Mr. Hsia. And we figured he was Eastern European.
Uh-huh.
Sounded Polish to us for some reason. That was our consensus anyway. So finally, this rather short in stature Chinese gentleman, 35-ish, 40, gets off the plane, and Ron just lets him walk by. And as John told it later, he just stood off to the side and watched Ron do his act. Everybody else till the plane was empty. And then there's no one else. He meandered over to Ron and said, are you Ron LeCount? He said, yes. He said, I'm John Shaw. I think you're looking for me.
That's funny.
I mean, the man had been our boss up in Cambridge for 6 months or more, and no one knew, you know.
That's funny.
Not that it made any difference, but it just showed what our communications were like. We were really independent. We were out there, and these observatories were totally self-sufficient, except for the money that would be deposited in the Curacao Bank for our operations every month. And that was about it. So I finally got a memo from John and Ron that I had been appointed station manager, promoted, which made Gene and I very happy, and that something came with my promotion. That they were having serious problems at the Spain station with the cooperating agency, which was the Spanish Naval Observatory. We were located on the Naval Observatory's grounds, and our contact was a man named Admiral Planeas, and a lieutenant in the Spanish Navy who was bilingual, Spanish and English, was one of our staff right at the observatory. And so the previous station manager, for some reason, just didn't hit it off with the lieutenant or the admiral. And if you know anything about Spaniards, they are very proud people. And here's this wise guy American, as it was portrayed to me, who doesn't give us any respect, give us information. I mean, it was just a mess. I think it had gotten to the point where Spain was considering ejecting us. And so Ron, I'm sure it was because Ron and I were such good friends and worked so closely, thought I was the person to go over there and solve all of these diplomatic problems. For some reason, I had started studying Spanish while in Curacao. Curacao speaks a language called Papiamento. It's only spoken on Curacao, Bonaire, and Aruba, the ABC Islands. And it's a wonderful language. At the time we were living there, in the 60s, the first book of Papiamento ever written came out. It was a spoken language. Hmm. And it was probably 50% Dutch, 50% Spanish, 20% Dutch, some Portuguese, some English, and some leftover Indian words from the Carib or Arawak Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the official business on Curacao was done in Dutch, including all of the schools.
Yeah.
But the population was 90% native and 10% Dutch. So the natives all spoke Papiamento at home. So the kids learned Dutch very quickly in school. And then they had to study from the earliest grades on three other languages. So you would meet any citizen of Curaçao, and they were fluent in four to five languages. And I mean fluent. It was incredible.
Wow.
We Americans felt very ignorant in their presence.
Yeah.
Even our garbage collector could speak five languages.